Again, welcome to today's program. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. You may register to ask a question by pressing star and one on your touch-tone phone. We'll take questions in turn during our Q&A session, and please note today's call is being recorded. It's now my pleasure to introduce Marialena Ngapie. Please begin.
Great. Thank you, Kevin, and thanks everybody for joining us today. This is the National Immigration Law Center's field call. My name is Marialena Ngapie. I'm the Executive Director. And we want to start by thanking each and one of you, not only for joining us today for this important discussion, but for all of the work that you do every day on behalf of low-income immigrant families in our country. So for today's agenda, we have a number of NILC advocates. We've got Shuming Chair, Josh Stelick, and Tanya Broder, who will be walking through the details of the bills, both on the Senate side as well as an overview of what has happened in the House so far and what we expect. And then we'll open it up for a Q&A, and we really encourage all of you to join us and share your thoughts and your questions, which will very much inform our process going forward at NILC as well. So to begin with, just as an overview on where we are today, as all of you know, the Senate passed its immigration reform bill last Thursday. The margin was 68 in favor and 32 against. It had a healthy Republican support, but majority Democrat, as expected. The bill as a whole has some very incredible gems, as I like to refer to them as. It includes a road to citizenship for many of the 11 million. There is an expedited path to citizenship for Dreamers and for farm workers in particular. We have, for the first time ever, very strong workers' rights priorities, which Josh will be sharing, and I flag that simply because as many of you and we at NILC have been working on advocating on workers' rights issues within immigration reform, in every previous CIR debate, we at NILC have tried very, very hard to try to incorporate workers' rights protections and have been unable to until this time around. We also have the provision that allows for certain people who qualify who've been deported to be able to come back to the United States to be reunited with their family members. There are a lot of barriers for low-income immigrants, particularly in terms of the cost issue. But again, there have been some improvements in the bill along the way, particularly during the markup process, which we had a call after that, and many of you may have joined us. On the very troubling side, as all of you probably have heard, the Senate bill took a really, really hard turn to the right in the last couple of weeks with the Corker-Hoven Amendment. And the two pieces that we at NILC have been highlighting include, on the one hand, the excessive, extreme, and expensive militarization of the border. We're talking about adding another $46 billion to more border enforcement at a time when the border is stronger and has been more secure than ever before under this administration, where migration from Mexico is at net zero, and where we have had a humanitarian crisis for many, many years, given the existing border enforcement that has resulted in lots of deaths. Racial profiling and use of excessive force by border agents. So that was one particular part that I know for many, many people in the movement, it has caused great concern. We at the National Immigration Law Center have also been really concerned about the development that has resulted in basically federal government taking a decade worth of people's earnings, which Tanya will talk a little bit about later when we talk about access to benefits and health care and safety net issues. So the final bill that passed in the Senate is definitely not only a compromised bill, but a much more conservative bill than it really needed to be. Frankly, this came as a result of Democratic leadership thinking that they had to have or wanted to have more than 70 votes in support of the Senate bill, and as a result of that, they conceded more than really needed to have been done. So that's the overview of the Senate bill. I'll come back and talk a little bit about the House afterwards, but first we'll start with Shuming, who will talk a little bit about some of the details in the Senate bill.
Thanks. So I'm just going to briefly cover some of the legalization and enforcement provisions of the Senate bill that we actually think are pretty positive. As Marilena mentioned, the bill does create a road to citizenship for many of the undocumented people in this country. We are also pleased with the Dreamer provisions, which are generous. There's no upper age limit for the Dreamer provisions. So basically, somebody who came to the U.S. before the age of 16 and graduated from high school or received a GED and attends at least 2 years of college or 4 years in the military would qualify for a faster path to obtaining their citizenship. Normally, the path for somebody to obtain their registered provisional immigrant status and then become a lawful permanent resident would take 10 years. For Dreamers, they can apply for their LPR or lawful resident status after 5 years and also for citizenship at the same time. In terms of some of the changes to the border, there are a few positive changes. One of them is that Department of Homeland Security must establish standards for children in custody and ensure that they receive humane treatment. There's also a border oversight task force that will be created. That task force will conduct hearings and take testimony in order to review and recommend changes to existing border policies. Also, Customs and Border Patrol officers must be trained in child welfare and family law, and they must consider the best interests of the child and take into consideration family unity when they detain young people. In terms of access to justice, right now a lot of people filing for asylum have challenges because they're subject to a one-year filing deadline. So this bill eliminates the requirement that they apply for asylum within 1 year. The bill also creates an Office of Legal Access, which will provide legal orientation to people who are detained in immigration detention centers. And so these orientations are a way for people to know what their rights are and how they can defend their deportation case. The bill also allows people who are in immigration detention to receive bonds more quickly so that there's the chance that they could be released quicker than they are now. It also requires increased inspections of detention facilities and also restricts enforcement actions at sensitive locations. So in the past, there's been raids at places such as close to places of worship or close to places such as hospitals or schools. And so this bill would limit enforcement actions at those types of sensitive locations. There's also some judicial review for people who are denied their application for the temporary RPI status or people who have their RPI status revoked. This judicial review would take place in federal district court. So I'll stop there right now because I have a lot more to share, I think, on the negative side. But right now I'll pass it on to Josh to talk about some of the positive aspects around workers' rights.
Thanks, Shuming. So we're very pleased at NILC to see that many of NILC's key workers' rights priorities for immigration reform are reflected in the Senate bill and that they came through the Senate process mostly intact. As Maria Elena mentioned, that has not been the case in prior immigration reform fights. And so that was a victory for us. And amongst these priorities are the inclusion of Power Act provisions in the Senate bill. And what these provisions do is expand the availability of the U visa, which is currently available to immigrant victims of certain types of crimes. And the Senate bill would make that U visa available to workers who experience significant workplace abuse. So this would provide for immigration relief for immigrant workers who are retaliated against on the job or who experience exploitation in the workplace. Another key priority for NILC that is included in the Senate bill is a remedy for the Supreme Court decision in Hoffman Plastics v. National Labor Relations Board. And what that does, that provision then specifies that an immigrant worker who's wrongfully fired or retaliated against for asserting her rights in the workplace shall not be denied back pay or other damages based on her immigration status. The inclusion of mandatory E-Verify in the Senate bill is a bitter pill for NILC, since we have long been opposed to the E-Verify system. However, the Senate bill does create or include worker protections and due process provisions for U.S. citizen workers and work-authorized immigrants who are wrongfully flagged in the E-Verify system. And the bill also includes affirmative penalties for employers who misuse the E-Verify system, for example, to discriminate against workers or to retaliate against them. And both the due process provisions and the affirmative employer penalties that are provided for in the Senate bill are not part of the current E-Verify program as it currently exists. Finally, there are portability provisions for W visa holders. So the bill creates a W visa for future temporary workers who come to the U.S. to work in, to do non-agricultural work for registered employers. And the bill allows these workers who have W visas to switch to other registered employers once they're here. And that's a significant worker protection so that temporary workers who come to the U.S. under a W visa are not beholden to the sponsoring employer who brought them here to maintain their immigration status. And finally, in terms of positive worker rights provisions in the Senate bill, we were very relieved to see that the Senate did not make any worse the requirement that individuals in RPI status show proof of regular employment in order to renew their RPI status and ultimately to adjust to LPR status. While we continue to be concerned about the ability of individuals with RPI status to meet that regular employment requirement and to prove up regular employment during the RPI period, there were several amendments that had been offered in the Senate Judiciary Committee and that were filed on the floor that would have made the requirement even more stringent or would have narrowed the types of evidence that individuals could use to prove their regular employment. And none of these amendments ultimately passed either in committee or on the floor. So now I'm going to turn it over to Tanya, who's going to touch briefly on the good provisions related to public benefits in the bill.
Thanks, Josh. Just to talk about access to health care, public benefits, and educational opportunity, not too much to say, but happily the bill restores Medicaid for individuals who entered the U.S. under the Compact of Freely Associated States. That's from Micronesia, Palau, and the Marshall Islands, who serve U.S. strategic interests, and folks are allowed to come into the U.S. as non-immigrants and remain permanently. Now they'll have access to Medicaid if the bill goes through. We also were able to get access to federal public housing and Section 8 assistance for qualified immigrant domestic violence survivors, which will assist them in living independently from their abusers. These are people who have filed a self-petition for immigration relief under the Violence Against Women Act and others whose spouse or parent are either U.S. citizens or lawful permanent residents and have petitioned for them to gain LPR status. Finally, for Dreamers and Blue Card holders who entered the U.S. Before the age of 16 or who have a Blue Card, they will have access to federal work study and student loans, but not Pell Grants, which will help them fulfill the educational requirements to get LPR status as a Dreamer and otherwise help people continue their education. Those are the bright spots of the current bill on public benefits and health care. And I guess the other point is that the bill continues, and we had to fight for this, continues to allow people to pay the same taxes and qualify for the same deductions and tax credits as other taxpayers. And the main efforts have been to try and take away things for low-income families like the earned income tax credit or the child tax credit. Those are still preserved under existing rules. Happily. That's about it for my good news.
Thanks, Tanya. So now we're going to shift to some of the really disappointing parts of where the Senate bill ended up, and Shuming is going to kick it off as well on the legalization provisions.
So while there is a road to citizenship that's provided for in the Senate bill, there's also many roadblocks, or many people have called them, it's almost like an obstacle course that people have to run before they can become citizens. And so some of the sections that would shut out a lot of people from ultimately becoming citizens include the fact that for a person to get their temporary RPI status, they must have arrived in the U.S. on or before December 31st, 2011. So this will shut out a lot of people who arrived after that date. In addition, I think most of you have heard about the hefty penalties that people are going to be subject to. That includes $1,000 when people apply for their initial RPI status, and another $1,000 when people are ready to apply for their legal permanent resident status. In addition to the penalties, there's also application fees, which we don't know what they'll be right now, but we do know at this point in time the application fee for people to become lawful permanent residents is close to $1,000. So when we add up all the fees, penalties, it's really going to be an obstacle and a burden for many low-income immigrants. Also, for people to maintain their temporary status, they have to be regularly employed. Also, there's a requirement that people must learn English, and we know that many English classes have limited availability, and it's difficult when people are working full-time jobs to get enrolled into some of these classes. There's an 18-month period for people to apply for this temporary RPI status that can be extended for a year. And so one of the main concerns is that that is not enough time for people to be informed about the program, to gather the money that they will need to pay for all the fines and fees, or to gather all the supporting documents they'll need to prove that they meet the requirements. I think also one of the really negative aspects of the bill is just the number of triggers that must be met before people can actually adjust to become LPRs. The triggers include implementation of the E-Verify system, includes implementation of an electronic exit system at all international air and sea ports. It also includes hiring an additional 19,200 Border Patrol agents, which would almost double the number of Border Patrol agents that we currently have. And one of the triggers also includes basically implementing the Comprehensive Southern Border Security Strategy, which would involve monitoring and surveillance of 100% of the southern border. And so just to delve a little bit more into some of the really troubling border aspects, people are calling it a border surge because this is basically massive infusion of money and resources into the border, particularly the southern border. This is really going to harm the health and safety of many people who live close to the border. One of the changes in the Senate bill is an additional $30 billion appropriated for additional Border Patrol agents. Also, the National Guard will be deployed to the southern border. The bill also allows for the recruitment of former members of the armed forces to be deployed to the border. And it also increases the number of people who are going to be prosecuted in federal criminal court for simply trying to enter the country for the first time or trying to re-enter the country again after they've been deported. So that goes hand in hand with increasing the penalties for people who are trying to enter unlawfully or re-entering unlawfully. So I think the net result is going to be that we're going to see a lot more people who are prosecuted and serving longer periods of time in federal prison. Just quickly, in terms of the other interior enforcement bits, the bill does increase the number of people who could potentially be deported based on certain types of behavior or on convictions. This includes people who have been involved in gangs or have convictions for crimes related to gang participation. It also makes it easier to deport people who have committed domestic violence offenses. And we're concerned because often it's hard to tell in those instances who actually is the survivor and who is the offender. And also, this doesn't allow for the fact that many people may have rehabilitated or have many other positive factors in their life. So I think this may probably enough on the negative aspects for the enforcement and legalization section. So I'll turn it over to Josh again.
From the workers' rights perspective, I think the inclusion of the E-Verify mandate is a major concession in the bill, and it's one of the primary mechanisms in the bill to increase interior immigration enforcement in the U.S. So the Senate bill does require all employers to use E-Verify to verify the employment eligibility of newly hired employees, and that requirement is phased in over a five-year period based on employer size, with larger employers having to join the E-Verify system sooner and smaller ones later in the five-year rollout. The problem with the electronic employment verification system, well, there are many, but it does not prevent abusive employers from gaming the system and exploiting workers, particularly workers who won't qualify for legalization under the bill. And we know that such workers will ultimately be pushed further into the underground economy where they're more vulnerable to exploitation and abuse. The Senate bill also creates a new Social Security fraud provision, which provides for civil and criminal penalties for misuse of a Social Security number or a Social Security card. Under our analysis, though, this doesn't expand the scope of criminal conduct significantly beyond what's already criminalized under federal law, so this provision is not as bad as it could have been. And with that, I'll turn it over to Tanya to talk about negative provisions in the pertaining to public benefits and the safety net.
Thanks, Josh. Well, mainly focusing on the people who gain a new status under the bill, whether it's the RPIs or the blue card holders or people with a V non-immigrant status, they will not have access for the most part to the major federal public benefit programs, that is non-emergency Medicaid, CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, SNAP, which was is the new name for food stamps, or SSI. Not only during the time when they're in that status, but for an additional 5 years after they gain lawful permanent residence. So what this means is at least a 13 to 15-year wait for people with RPI status to get those benefits, 5 to 10 years for Dreamers, 8 to 10 years for people who would get blue cards under the Ag Jobs provisions, and at least whatever number of years Vs have their status plus the 5 years in green card status. So it's a long, long wait for access to basic critical health care, nutrition, and assistance for people to survive. In terms of the new health care law that will go into effect in January, most of the provisions, people who gain these new statuses will be able to purchase health coverage through the new health insurance exchanges, but they're going to need to pay full cost for that. They will not qualify for the tax credits or subsidies that everyone else will get in order to make this health insurance affordable. Not only does the bill exclude this group from access to subsidies, it reaches out to a couple of groups that are potentially eligible now under existing law for health coverage under the Affordable Care Act. That is people who come into the U.S. either as tourists or business or for business purposes or as students. These are groups that many of them would not have been eligible in the first place because they may not be state residents, but a few of them might have been eligible if they're here long term, like the students who may change their intent. They will not be able even to purchase health care coverage at full cost under the new law or the new bill. Children and pregnant women who have either B or F visa holders across the country would not be eligible for Medicaid or CHIP in the states that choose to provide that coverage to lawfully residing children and pregnant women without a waiting period. So that was a disappointment for us. One of the biggest disappointments, as Maria Elena pointed out, is for Social Security purposes, people who have RPI status or who obtained a Social Security number after the year 2004, and those who overstayed a non-immigrant visa in the past will not be able to claim credit for any of the work that they performed between the years of 2004 and 2014 while they were not authorized to work. So any quarter where they were not authorized to work, they will not get credit for that work, even though they worked and may have paid Social Security taxes on that income. It robs them of 10 years of work, up to 10 years of work during the period. Once they get the RPI status, and looking forward, they will be able to gain credit for their work, but some may become old, may get a disability, or may die before getting enough credit, and this will affect not only the workers, but their children, dependents, and survivors. So that's the sad note I end on.
Thank you, Tanya. As folks can hear from the reports that we've provided, You know, the Senate bill, as it was finally passed out of the Senate, definitely provides a very long and arduous and at sometimes punitive road to citizenship with a lot of roadblocks, particularly for low-income immigrants. On the other hand, it provides a lot of benefits, as we've heard today as well, and I think this has been one of the struggles that many organizations around the country have been dealing with. And so we're going to shift over to briefly to the House. While many of us have been focused on the Senate, the House has actually passed four bills out of the House Judiciary Committee in the last 2 weeks. And so we will go over particularly on the SAFE Act and the Legal Workforce Act and a couple of the other bills that passed as well and what happened in those hearings. But just to set the kind of stage for what's happening on the House, the fact that the Corker-Hoven Amendment, which is the last amendment that was added, this is the border and kind of equivalent of wage theft by the government, when that was added to the Senate bill, unfortunately, although we got a couple of extra votes, Republican votes, in exchange for those huge concessions, what it also has done is that on the House side, Republicans want to go back to the negotiating table on the issue of border benefits and legalization before they sign off on the House bipartisan bill that was very close to being introduced, or at least that's what the House gang of seven has been saying. So that bill is yet to be finalized. We don't know even when it will be introduced, although the hope is that they will be able to reach some agreement soon and it will be filed. In the meantime, the big question is whether any of the four bills that we'll be talking about shortly will move through the floor on the House side, get a vote, and then one or two or all of them, whatever the vehicle is, that whatever those bills are that pass on the House floor, that will get conference with the Senate bill. And then, of course, once the conference process is over, they will be reported out, and then the Senate and House will have to vote on the final bill. Big question is whether Speaker Boehner will allow for a majority of the representatives to vote for these bills rather than a majority of the Republicans, or the majority of the majority, as is often referred to, or the Hastert rule, as it's referred to as well. So there are a lot of unanswered questions on the House. The next few weeks will be really critical. In July, the focus will be exclusively on the House. July 10th, the Republican caucus will be meeting in Washington, D.C., and coming out of that will be important to get a sense of where the Republican Party as a whole sees the, you know, what the strategy is with respect to immigration. So next Wednesday will be a really critical day. The other piece I would just add is that especially on the House and from this point forward, the field strategy becomes even more critical. It's going to be really important for House Republicans and conservative Democrats on the House side to really hear from the community about what kind of immigration reform we voted for back in November and what kind of immigration reform benefits our communities and our country rather than the enforcement-only approaches that we've seen so far coming out of the House Judiciary Committee. So with that, I will shift to NILC staff again to walk us through. So Xu Ming will talk about the SAFE Act to begin with.
So the SAFE Act, which stands for the Strengthen and Fortify Enforcement Act, was reported out of the House Judiciary Committee on June 18, 2013. And so it would definitely not make our communities safer. It's been compared to the Sensenbrenner Bill, which in 2006 is what sparked the massive protests by millions of people. One of the sections of the SAFE Act would expand the crime of illegal entry. So right now, somebody who's caught entering the country is subject to criminal prosecution for illegal entry. And what this act does is it makes it a continuing offense for a person to be here in the country unlawfully. And it also criminalizes anybody who overstays a visa, even if they only do so by one day, and regardless of any of the circumstances of why they've overstayed their visa. And so basically this would subject anybody who's here in the country without status to criminal prosecution. The SAFE Act also creates very harsh consequences for anybody who has a DUI conviction. It would make somebody with one DUI conviction permanently ineligible to legalize their status. And as we've seen with a lot of people who've been applying under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, there's actually quite a few people who have some kind of DUI history in their past, even if it's been many years since that's happened. The Act also would criminalize people who transport or, quote-unquote, harbor somebody else who's undocumented. So this means that if I'm driving a parent, a child, my neighbor, a friend who's undocumented, that I could be prosecuted for smuggling aliens. And so these are some of the very troublesome aspects. For NILC, in the past couple of years, we focused on litigation to ensure that states like Arizona don't enforce their own version of immigration laws. And the SAFE Act would basically allow every state to do so. It would allow states and local jurisdictions to basically create and implement their own criminal and civil penalties for federal immigration violations. It would also allow state and local law enforcement officers to engage in all the work that federal immigration enforcement agents currently do, meaning that if somebody stopped during a routine traffic stop, a local law enforcement officer could inquire about the immigration status, they could detain them, arrest them, and also keep them in jail until the time that they're picked up by ICE. So there's also a lot of other extremely harmful and worrisome provisions that are part of the SAFE Act. And so we do have a write-up, a summary of some of the major sections of it on our website, which you all are welcome to look at if you want to get more information about the SAFE Act. Okay. Josh?
Another bill that has passed through in the House Judiciary Committee is the Legal Workforce Act. So the House Judiciary Committee marked up and ultimately passed the Legal Workforce Act last Wednesday, June 26th. And the Legal Workforce Act is a standalone E-Verify mandate that would require all employers to use E-Verify. Unlike the Senate bill, the Legal Workforce Act has no legalization component, nor does it contain any of the worker protections or the due process safeguards that are contained in the E-Verify portion of the Senate bill. And the Legal Workforce Act would speed up E-Verify implementation so that all employers ultimately would have to use it within a two-year time frame as compared to the five-year rollout under the Senate bill. At the markup, the Democrats' message was basically that mandatory E-Verify will not work without legalization. And the Democrats offered upwards of 20 affirmative amendments to improve the bill, to include due process provisions within the bill. There was an amendment to include a legalization component to the bill. And all of these Democrat amendments were defeated on strict party line votes, except for one vote in which Republican Representative Farenthold did vote in favor of one Democrat amendment, but that amendment still failed. So ultimately, the Legal Workforce Act was voted out of committee on party lines, and we anticipate that it could be brought to the floor of the House in July before the August recess. So we're continuing to work with our workers' rights coalition allies to develop an amendment strategy. I did want to highlight one exchange that happened during the Legal Workforce Act markup between Representative Gutierrez and Representative Labrador, where Representative Gutierrez had offered an amendment that would create a trigger under which the E-Verify mandate could not go forward unless and until a legalization program was adopted by DHS. And that sparked an exchange with Labrador, who's a Republican representative, who basically did explicitly say acknowledged that E-Verify without legalization was a problem, but then he went on to say that it wasn't clear from his perspective what level of legalization was appropriate, and therefore he did not support Gutierrez's amendment. And I think that exchange was notable. On the one hand, it was heartening to see a fairly conservative Republican acknowledge the need for legalization, but on the other, it did also reflect, at least his perspective, that a legalization that potentially stops short of citizenship would be satisfactory. So I think it does reflect the amount of work we have cut out for us in the House. And then I just briefly wanted to touch on two other immigration bills that did pass out of the House Judiciary Committee. One was the Agricultural Guest Worker Act, and that basically deprives current farm workers who lack authorized immigration status the opportunity to earn a green card or citizenship, while the act simultaneously proposes a new agricultural guest worker program that doesn't contain any of the worker protections that are contained in the Senate bill, and so could lead to lower wages and ultimately more exploitive working conditions for farm workers. And then finally, the Skills Visa Act, which was passed last Thursday out of the House Judiciary Committee and would eliminate the current diversity visa program and green cards for siblings in favor of increasing high-skilled visas. So that's sort of a synopsis of the four essentially enforcement-only bills that have been passed by the House Judiciary Committee in the last 2 weeks.
So at this point, we wanted to open it up and hear your feedback on how you view the immigration reform process so far, what you think of the Senate bill in terms of the both the positive and the negative aspects. And also, if you have any questions, feel free to ask them.
Hey, Kevin, could you please give instructions on how people line up, queue up?
To ask a question, please press star and one on your touchtone phone. If your question has been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Again, to ask a question, please press the star and one keys. We'll pause for a moment.
Great, thank you. And again, if people, we definitely not only want to hear your questions, but also any comments you have about where how your organization is viewing where we are right now in immigration reform.
And we have a couple questions in queue. We can go first to the line of Von Cox with Lupe. Your line is open.
Yes, good afternoon. First of all, where we are. Now, we're located on the southern border of Texas, right, just a stone's throw from the river. We are not thrilled with the border security portions and, but the rest of the Senate bill seems fair. I mean, it could always be better, right, and we could all have pie in the sky. my question is about the DACA provisions in the Senate bill, the DREAM provisions, under DACA, students only needed to demonstrate that they were in high school or have completed high school. The DREAM provisions seem to have a two-year college requirement. For current DACA recipients, will that be an additional requirement?
Go ahead, Shuminko.
Go for it, Tanya.
All right. People with who have DACA under the bill will have a streamlined process to get RPI status, so they don't need anything more in order to – they have to have, entered the U.S. before age 16 and have the same requirements that they had for DACA. The 2 years of college is what's required in order to adjust to a green card, to LPR status, and there are some alternatives – 4 years in the military and some other exceptions that they could meet in order to get the green card. But they could have RPI status first without having to complete the college years.
Okay.
Shuming, you can add to it if you want.
Very good. That was what I was wondering.
Okay.
And Vaughn, this is Maria Elena. I'm just wondering if you could share how Lupe is, have you guys taken a position on the Senate bill at all, or how are you seeing kind of as the fight unfolds in the House, particularly on the border issues?
Well, we're concerned that the House is going to go even further than the Senate in terms of border security and militarizing the border. We have to live and work in this environment. It's a 100-mile constitution-free zone, and so that's our concern. Increasing the number of Border Patrol agents will only increase their anxiety to do whatever it takes to capture alleged immigrants. And so our concern is that they're going to be even more aggressive in terms of beating and shooting and doing other bad things to people who look like they may be immigrants. It's kind of a shoot first, the Texas style, shoot first, ask questions later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, I mean, we at NILC are definitely very concerned and committed to working with all of you on the border to scale this back. I think, you know, the fact that even Senator Corker, I think it was Corker or Hoeven, themselves, right, they, you know, they're the sponsors of this amendment, said this was overkill, that even for them, the border surge was much greater than they expected. So I think there will be a need for a very broad, you know, set of stakeholders from the community, from those, you know, who live and work in the community on the border to really stand up against this and for all of us in the interior to work with you in terms of scaling this back. So thank you for joining again today.
Certainly.
Kevin, do we have any other questions? And if you can just remind people how to queue up, that would be great.
Again, if you'd like to ask a question, you can do so by pressing star and one on your touchtone phone. We do have another question in queue. We can go to the line of Patricia Silvavaro from Alpha. Your line is open.
Yes, hi there. I'm Patricia Silvavaro in Boston, Massachusetts. I can tell you that we've already had a couple of community forums in the area, and I think people are waiting to see how things are going to play out in the House, hoping that the bill will get better. But if I can use a quick illustration to tell you the sentiment of some of the churches around here, you know, they were saying that people are literally starving for a work permit, right, because they've been here for so long. But as one pastor eloquently said, we need to make sure that we don't take that plate of food that's going to be poisoned. So we have to just wait a little longer. Although people want to work and live and travel without the fear of being deported. So it's a very difficult situation. And my question is the following. If someone has been here for a number of years, let's say 10 years, and he was able to acquire his Social Security number, I guess it's a legal Social Security number, about 10 years ago, is he not going to be able to tap into that Social Security fund because he is undocumented but with a valid social?
So if he received his Social Security number after 2004 and now gains RPI status, is that your question?
He got his social before 2004.
Okay, so the restriction does not apply to people who obtained their Social Security number before 2004.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
And Patricia, where are you calling from? What part of the country?
Boston, Massachusetts.
Great, thank you. And thanks again for sharing, the challenge that many people in the community are feeling. Kevin, do we have any other questions lined up?
We do. We can go next to the line of Mari Lopez with Vision e Compromiso. Your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so very much for this call. I think it's really super helpful to have this conversation and everyone from across the country participating. We are within the camp of similar to what the earlier caller before me had expressed as well, that we're kind of like deer caught in the headlights sort of reaction to this bill, because while many of our folks are just happy to have something, we're really satisfied with what's being offered, especially particularly what they're asking in return of folks to receive some sort of legal status. And we are just concerned about the fact that, you know, there's a lot of organizations, as we understand, who are behind this, because I think that's the spirit is anything is better than nothing. But again, I'm concerned that this nothing is more detrimental than anything that we could possibly have. So my question is, and from what I've heard and understand, that there are no fixes that can be had in the future around this bill. And I wanted to hear a little bit more about that. Are there any tweaks, changes that we can make, in the foreseeable future, or is this what we have? Are we stuck with this?
So, Mari, thank you so much for your comments and questions and for the incredible work that all of you at Visión y Compromiso do. So I think in terms of the bill, the Senate bill has been voted on, right? So that's what we have coming out of the Senate. The House is all basically anything goes. both in terms of bad and good stuff. It depends on what vehicles end up moving through the House of Representatives, which, again, we don't know yet what those are. So that will be the one place for sure that all of us have to work on trying to both improve the bill and beat back a lot of bad stuff. And then the last place, and, you know, I think one of the challenges is we haven't been in a conference situation before on an immigration bill, but that will be the last place to really influence the conference. And so we will definitely have, if we get to that point in the legislative process, we'll definitely have many more conversations and calls like this to discuss how we both make sure that we get strong negotiators on our behalf on the conference. So, for example, I met with Senator Hirono from Hawaii last week, who frankly has been like the voice of consciousness in the Senate, and asked her, like, what do we need to do to get you on the conference committee? And she specifically said we need to talk to Senators Reid and Leahy, who will be determining that for the Democrats. And so we all, you know, we'll need to start a campaign to make sure that Senator Hirono sits on the conference committee. And she in particular, she is the only immigrant in the Senate. So there are many reasons. Not only is she brilliant, a great strategist, a great negotiator who has our back, but as the only immigrant in the Senate, she really needs to be there. So that, you know, is definitely my initial reaction, but I don't know if other Nilkers have anything else you want to share.
I mean, I think just that we really do have to double down on the House. It's obviously a Republican-controlled body, a less hospitable one than the Senate, but it is a place where we could still see some positive improvements to the bill that we have coming out of the Senate. So I just think it now is the time for us to all double down on our work with regard to the House.
Great. Thank you. Next question, Kevin.
We'll go next to the line of Patricia Onufrock, an interested party. Your line is open.
Hi. I'm on this call because I have two students from El Salvador. I'm calling from Falls Church, Virginia. I'm a little bit concerned about the comments about the penalties for using false Social Security numbers. I know from my students that almost all people who entered without inspection at some time at their time in the United States have used a false number, either a number that was made up or a number that had belonged to someone else. And I was wondering how this would affect people, for example, my students who have TPS, if it is found out that at one point before they got TPS, they were using a false number.
Josh, you might want to take that. Yeah.
Well, the bill does include a new Social Security fraud provision, the Senate bill. But under our analysis, it doesn't significantly or really perhaps at all expand the scope of conduct that's already criminal under federal law for misusing a Social Security number. So it's not as bad, I think, as it potentially could have been. But I think that that's something we have to really be on guard for throughout the remainder of the legislative process in terms of what comes out of the House, and then assuming something makes it to conference with the Senate bill, what happens with Social Security misuse provisions in the conference and ultimately in the final bills that get reported out of conference.
And Josh, just can you just add a little bit about what the, in terms of for people to apply for RPI status, the first stage of the road to citizenship for folks who have used the false SSN in terms of waivers and confidentiality provisions?
Maybe Shuming wants to handle that.
I mean, obviously right now we don't know what the application will look like. So I think one thing will be to ensure that your students are able to talk to an accredited representative or an immigration attorney to talk over these different scenarios. And, you know, there are confidentiality provisions that prevent information from the application being shared with ICE. But there are some exceptions. For example, if it turns out somebody has some type of serious criminal history. So I think one thing is to just figure out what will need to be disclosed at that point. And I think you might know this already, but there's also a quicker path to gaining LPR status for people who've been here for 10 years already with TPS.
Mm-hmm. Well, they were even talking about going directly to residency at one time. I don't know if that would it be LPR or would it be residency immediately for people because they've been here 10 years or more.
Yeah, so they're the same thing. It's residency and lawful permanent resident status and green card are the same thing. So, yeah, we're talking about the same thing. People would immediately have access to their LPR status.
Okay, thank you.
And in terms of the employment requirement, that really kicks in once somebody gains RPI status, and at that point should have also obtained a work authorization through their RPI application. So there's not a requirement that someone present proof of employment in the RPI application itself. It's only once the RPI status is granted that someone will have to then show that they've maintained regular employment from that point forward.
Great. Kevin, why don't we move on to the next question? I think we have time for maybe two more.
Go next to the line of Luis Narvazquet with Chicago Public Schools. Your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Here in Chicago, I'm part of the Chicago Public Schools. We have around 40,000 students, K through 12, who are undocumented, we believe. So at this point, we're about to meet with our high school and elementary school counselors regarding this issue. Should you recommend, that we hold on regarding telling folks things are going on since nothing's secure at this time, or what kind of information can we provide to our counselors regarding the legislation that's going on?
Well, we do have some materials posted on our website, but you're welcome to share, including a short chart summarizing the positive and negative aspects of the Senate bill. I do think it's important to talk at least about what is some of the broader pieces of the Senate bill, just because people hear about it on the media anyways. But just to really emphasize, like you said, that at this point it's a bill, we don't have a law yet, and people can't apply for anything, including any kind of temporary status at this point. So emphasizing that part of it, but letting them know that, yeah, this is being talked about in Congress, and these are some of the key aspects of it.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. And then did I hear correctly that under this current bill, DACA recipients would need 2 years of college in order to qualify for permanent residency?
That was the DREAM provision. So after somebody is in their temporary status as a DREAMer, they would need to show the 2 years of college to then move on to adjusting their status.
Okay, perfect. That's great. We're trying to push higher education, so this is just terrific in that work that we're doing. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Luis. Kevin, next question.
We'll go next to the line of Patricia Hatch with Maryland Immigrant Rights Coalition. Your line is open.
Yes. Once RPIs have completed the 10-year wait and are ready to apply for LPR status, you alluded to the fact that they're going to have to show that they've been continuously employed with no more than 30 days consecutive out of work. I know that there are some ameliorating factors there for instance, people who are disabled or at home with children, but I'm very concerned that this is like a Trojan horse that's going to keep people in limbo forever because having just experienced what the economy has done to even U.S. citizens in the last few years, it seems very unrealistic to expect that a person who is applying for permanent resident status not have been employed for more than 30 consecutive, unemployed for more than 30 consecutive days. Does there seem to be any hope whatsoever of doing any kind of amelioration of that?
Thanks for your comment, and we definitely share your concern about the potential roadblock that the regular employment requirement imposes. Just to clarify, though, under the terms of the Senate bill, someone is considered not regularly employed if they've been unemployed for 60 days or longer. So it's not a 30-day threshold. It is at least a 60-day. That said, that's obviously still a very stringent requirement. As you alluded to, the Senate bill does have several exceptions to that regular employment requirement, and those include age, disability, if someone's on a medical leave from work, if someone's providing or serving as a primary caretaker for a dependent. And then finally, one of the exceptions in the Senate bill is if somebody's unable to work due to circumstances outside of his or her control. So for us, I mean, we think that that could be interpreted fairly broadly, and we would hope for a fairly broad interpretation. But I think what that points out to us is the need to really, you know, assuming a bill actually gets through Congress, really thinking about how it gets implemented and how regulations implementing the bill will look. So kind of a broad standard like unable to work due to circumstances beyond the individual's control, how that gets interpreted by the government and implemented will be very important. So even after a bill passes, we'll still have a lot of work cut out for us to make sure that it's implemented fairly and appropriately.
Great, and that's a really good point to end on, Josh. I think in response to some of the previous questions that Mahdi and others asked, the legislative process is one place to influence that, but if a bill were to become law and signed into law by President Obama, then the administrative advocacy will be the other place where we'll have another shot at trying to improve the language in terms of how the agencies will implement the program, and then, of course, similarly at the state and local level in terms of how educational systems will implement the program, state, local counties, et cetera. So unfortunately, we have run out of time, and I know a number of you still had questions. Feel free to email us with any questions or comments. We really value your thoughts on this and, of course, want to continue serving as a resource. We will continue to have these field calls on a regular basis as developments occur. We will continue sending out alerts, especially as the House bill or bills move through the process. And then please do check out our website so that you can access materials, give us your feedback on those materials. If there are other types of materials that you need that you think would be helpful for you and your communities, please let us know. And the final thank you to all of you and, of course, to the incredible Milk staff that have just done really heroic work up to this point on immigration reform. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you.